In the first hour today, we'll be talking about historic preservation and saving endangered places. And we have two guests with us, both who are interested in this issue and who deal with it on kind of two different levels, one on a national level and one on a state level. We have, and joining us both by phone, Richard Moe, president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and also David Ballman. He is executive director of the Landmarks Preservation Council of Illinois. We'll try to talk about some of the basic issues, and at least we'll deal with at least one specific example that'll give us a case study, an opportunity to talk about some of the basic issues, and that is the effort to try to preserve a house designed by a very famous architect, Mies van der Rohe, that's here in the state of Illinois. It's called the Farnsworth House. It's near Aurora. I will talk about that and a number of other things. And, of course, as we talk, if people who are listening would like to be a part of the conversation, that's certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving. But anyone listening is welcome to contribute their thoughts, ask questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. But we do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. If you would be happen to be listening over the Internet, in fact, as long as you were in the United States, you can even use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Well, Mr. Moe, hello.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you very much for giving us your time. And Mr. Ballman.
Good morning, David.
We appreciate it, both of you being with us. I thought I would just take a moment here at the beginning to give each of you a chance to talk a little bit about your organizations, and maybe I'll start with Richard Moe, and have you talk just for a moment about the mission of the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
The National Trust was founded a little more than 50 years ago, chartered by the Congress, actually, to be the nation's leading national preservation organization. Originally, we started out saving great historic houses and operating them as house museums. We still do that, including several outstanding places in the Chicago area. But we've also become very programmatic. We have regional offices all over the country, including one in Chicago. We have Main Street programs to try to revitalize deteriorated downtowns. We're an advocacy organization in both a legal and public policy sense. So we're an all-purpose preservation organization, all of it geared to trying to save the best of our heritage as represented in the built environment. Mm.
And Mr. Ballman, I expect that as far as the Landmarks Preservation Council of Illinois is concerned, the mission is much the same, just confined to what goes on within the borders of the state?
That's correct, David. We were established about 32 years ago around the battle to save the Sullivan and Adler Stock Exchange building here in Chicago. We weren't successful in saving that building, but the organization, the Landmarks Preservation Council, was formed around that battle, and we've been doing the same thing the National Trust has been doing for more years than we've been around, just here in Illinois, trying to save important buildings and sites here in Illinois.
Let me ask a very basic question, one that probably could occupy us for some time, and that's this. We know that the built environment does change. Tastes change, which may or not be an important reason for tearing down buildings. Needs change. And we know that everything cannot be preserved, and I suppose not everything is worth being preserved. So the question is, how do we decide what buildings are worth saving?
Well, that's a very, very good question. It gets right to the core of what we're all about, of course. It's really largely in the eye of the beholder, like beauty itself. Although we do have certain rules for what is considered legally historic, and that's there's a set of criteria for that in terms of being on the National Register and so forth. But that's not all encompassing. Basically, what we're trying to do at the National Trust is to encourage each community to decide for itself what it thinks is worth preserving in that community and what it thinks can best serve its future needs, perhaps through an adaptive use of a significant historic structure or whatever. So it's there's not a one-size-fits-all answer to that question. But as with beauty, you kind of know it when you see it. Those structures and neighborhoods and streetscapes that are very important to the character of a community are usually those things that a community wants to save.
We're having trouble, David, convincing a lot of communities to enact landmark ordinances to do what Dick has suggested here, which is to get each community to take the responsibility of deciding what's important and what isn't. We're dealing with a huge number of communities who want to preserve their personal property rights, but they also don't want that beautiful Queen Anne house next door demolished. So we're caught in between a lot with these communities who aren't willing to take the step to enact a landmark ordinance, do a survey, and have some control without owner consent over the buildings in their communities, which add to the public benefit of and quality of life issues. It's a real struggle to get people to understand that they can't have it both ways. they can't have a no land use regulation situation and yet at the same time protect the things that they decide are important. So it's a tough situation for us to deal with all the individual communities here in Illinois.
Mm. I suppose there could be a number of reasons, any number of reasons why an individual building might be taken down. It could be that the building itself truly hasn't been well maintained, and so it would cost a great deal of money to fix all the things wrong with it. It could simply be a matter of modernizing its mechanical systems. It could be an issue of perhaps better use of the land the building is sitting on. And although I think probably when it comes down to it, the thing that seems to irk people most and maybe a leading reason for tearing older buildings down is simply an enthusiasm for the new. And I wonder, when you think about all the reasons that things get taken down, is it in fact that the leading contender for reasons is that people just don't have a lot of respect for older buildings and somehow have this idea in their head that if it's new, it's better?
Well, I think that does go in large part to answer your question. We consider ourselves to be a relatively young country, and that's always been part of our belief system that new is better than old, and therefore tear down the old and build anew. That attitude happily is changing, and it's changing largely because people increasingly value older structures in their neighborhoods or in their cities combined with new architecture. The most vital cities in America combine the best of older architecture with the best of new architecture, and there's no city that better represents that than Chicago. That's precisely why I think, as an outsider, why Chicago is such an interesting and compelling and really vital city. And happily, those attitudes are changing all over the country to bring greater appreciation to older buildings. For example, I hope David would agree that if the Chicago Stock Exchange building were at risk today, it would be saved. I believe that's also true of Penn Station in New York, which played a similar role in compelling a community to recognize the severity and permanence of the loss, and that really gave birth to the preservation movement. So we're not there yet, but attitudes are changing. And I think the more revitalization work and the more restoration work that occurs, and I've seen much of it in Chicago that I greatly admire, the more public support there is for this kind of activity.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dick. I think from my point of view here in Chicago, one of the greatest problems, other than just the lack of interest in the old and an appreciation for things historic, the greatest problem is that for many developers who are uneducated and unexperienced in doing rehabilitation or adaptive reuse projects, it's much easier for them to scrape a site and build a new building. It's less trouble. Until the learning curve is achieved, until a developer does a rehabilitation or an adaptive reuse project and learns what the sort of gimmicks are to make it a good project, it can be slightly more expensive for him because there is that learning curve that he's involved in. But without exception, if we have a recalcitrant developer who wants to tear down a beautiful building, once we can convince him the preservation project is a better alternative, And once he does one good project, we don't have, our job is done. The education portion of it is over. They almost, in every instance, the developer will go on to be very, very enthusiastic about rehabilitation and adaptive reuse projects. So there's a learning curve that developers and contractors and real estate professionals have to get past before they understand that this can be done and it can produce better results.
I would just like to underscore that. And I think it's one of the most significant and unnoted facts that's accounted for the greater restoration preservation work being done. We now have a coterie of developers all over the country who have learned how to do this kind of work and make a buck off of it, and that's a very good thing.
Well, let me ask another basic question, and this may be kind of splitting hairs, but I'm interested in what you say. Supposing that we have a building that's an historic building, and someone comes in and says, I would like to save this building, but adapt its use so that it can be practical for modern use. So we take that building and we gut it. So all that's left is the skin of the building, and into that building then we put modern mechanical systems, and maybe we'll put new windows, and we'll insulate it so will be very energy efficient and turn it into something completely different. You know, maybe it had been a factory, and so what we're going to do is turn it into apartment space or lofts for artists, or we're going to make an office building or whatever it is. And the only thing that's going to be left from that building, of the original building, is going to be the skin. Is that historic preservation?
Yes, it is. It's what we call adaptive reuse. And that's what's accounting for a lot of the work being done with historic buildings in America today. Now, it depends upon the significance of the building as to whether or not you're going to gut the interior, because if the interior is historic also, then obviously you want to save it. But increasingly, with older factories or older commercial buildings or where you're dealing with affordable housing, the important thing is to adapt those structures to modern uses and keeping the historic exterior intact, because that's where the public benefit comes in, and that's why tax credits are sometimes available for those kinds of projects.
David, it's always a case by case situation. We are primarily involved in, as Dick said, in the public benefit portion of the building, which is the exterior. If you're taking an old warehouse building or a manufacturing building and putting condominiums in it, that's, you know, there are absolutely no objections there whatsoever. But if you're taking, I was thinking of an instance in San Francisco a few years ago, one of the oldest structures in San Francisco, not destroyed by the fire in 1906, a Jewish synagogue that a developer wanted to gut and turn into condominiums without preserving any of the interior details, which were all absolutely original to 1880. If it's a structure of, you know, cultural as well as historic significance, you know, you wouldn't want to do to an intact synagogue what you did to a pipe company. So you have to look at each building on its own merits. You have to look at the importance of the interiors. You know, the best case scenario would be always, you know, to reuse a theater as a theater, reuse a church as a church, reuse a school as a school. But when you get into types of structures that are easily adaptable, preservationists have no objection whatsoever to adaptive reuse programs.
We have a couple of callers, and I want to bring them into the conversation. And for anyone who's tuned in within the last 10 minutes or so, I should introduce again our guests. Last person you heard speak, David Ballman, is Executive Director of the Landmarks Preservation Council of Illinois. And also with us is Richard Moe. He's President of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And we're talking about historic preservation and saving endangered places. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. First caller up is in Belgium, near Danville, in line 4. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to point out to your guests and your listeners that over here in Danville area, as you suggested, we're a community that is slowly dying, and we've lost a lot of churches, buildings, and everything, and they're tearing a lot of them down. Now, some of them definitely deserve to come down. restore them. But I've suggested to some folks that, you know, inside these buildings are amazingly large warehouses and fabulous materials, namely lumber. The churches are just full of stained glass windows and stuff that can be recycled. Fixtures that are not available anymore and some things. It seems to me that it would be very good to maybe tear down the worst, save the materials, and use that as a profit base to preserve the ones that really need more preserving. Is that function taking place anyplace?
That's a tough one, Dick.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that one exactly happening anywhere. Obviously, it depends upon how significant these buildings are. Even if a building is vacant, if it's significant architecturally or historically, you really don't want to do that damage to it, and you certainly don't want to tear it down. This may or may not apply to your community, but usually when buildings are torn down and for which there is no other purpose for the land, those spaces become parking lots for at least a generation.
Yes, sir. I agree 100% because that's exactly what's happened here.
Yeah.
Like I'm pointing out, some of these buildings are not historically significant at all. Some of them are, but the materials inside of it are of a quality that you cannot buy anymore. You might as well log the urban forest as just put it in a landfill and burn it or whatever.
Well, I think you know, Dick talked about the subjectivity of the importance of historic structures, and that's absolutely true. There are ways, however, of determining whether a building, there are architectural historians in the state of Illinois who can look at a building, look at its history, look at its architecture, and say, you know, this is something unique, this is something worth saving. Our definition of important structures, not only in Illinois but across the country, has broadened significantly in the last 20 years. One never considered the original McDonald's, the original McDonald's hamburger stand in Downey, California. 40 years ago, that wouldn't have been considered an important structure. Today, aficionados of the modernist movement consider that important historically and culturally. So I would say that, you know, any building that's over 50 years old should be looked at very, very carefully to see if there is something there that's worth saving. And architectural historians and landmark commissions who have a set of criteria to work with to determine historic and architectural significance should always be consulted first in situations like this before someone subjectively decides that building can be thrown away.
Yeah, that's unfortunate because many of these buildings are 100 years old.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. You're welcome.
I know that there is right here in our area in Champaign County an organization called the Preservation and Conservation Association, and they're doing precisely, at least in part, precisely what the caller suggests. They're looking at older buildings, and I think a lot of them do turn out to be homes around Champaign-Urbana, and if they see something that's slated to be torn down, and it may not be something that of great historical significance, but what they do is they go in and they try to salvage what they can,
mm-hmm.
and then they have a place here where you can go and you can buy things like moldings and siding and pillars that stood on somebody's front porch and railings from stairways and, you know, and windows, anything that's worth saving. The idea is that then that will be recycled. Somebody can use it. It can generate a little money that goes into the preservation effort. And I'm sure that there are other communities where things like that happen.
Dick and I don't like to talk about that, David.
Oh, I see, because you think, you know, somehow it makes it more acceptable, the idea of tearing a building down?
It's like developers around the country who have gotten into this whole facadism mode where they think the only thing of a building that's important that needs to be saved is the front facade of the building, 18 inches deep. You know, there are cases from time to time, very unique and very special cases, where saving just the facade might be the best you can get. But we don't like to talk about that either because, you know, a building is an organism. It has, you know, depth and height and width and plumbing and floors and, heating systems, it's a three-dimensional organism, and as much of that as we can save, as much historic fabric as we can save, that's where we want to be. So we don't like to talk about facades and projects, and we don't like to talk about salvage, because we want to make sure that everything is done first before you get to either of those situations.
Right. Well, let's talk with someone else. Near Hoopston, north of Danville, line one. Hello.
Yes. I'd like to talk about the Chicago Stockyards Inn, a building that should never have been torn down. It was the headquarters for the Saddle and Sirloin Club, for the Hall of Fame of Agriculture. Besides being a fabulous, fabulous building with many artifacts from Europe, and now the Saddle and Sirloin Club has moved to Louisville, Kentucky. The Hall of Fame has been moved to Kentucky. As a young boy, I got to be at one of the installations of one of the funks from Bloomington, the seed corn people, into the Hall of Fame, and then later years in the 80s, early 80s, was Earl Butts from Purdue. It was a fabulous, fabulous building. I have several stained glass windows out of it.
Well, we have about 350 other instances like that. It was a very important structure. Unfortunately, it was not protected by a local landmark ordinance. It should have remained.
The best thing about it was just the local, the history of the Sirloin Room and the Medieval Room, you know, all the old things from England, and then the Torridor Room, all these famous little places. But the best one was the Presidential Suite. I got the stained glass windows out of that ceiling. And there was also Harry Truman's piano. Mm-hmm. When they knocked the windows out, the rain came in and ruined the piano, but they wouldn't give it away or sell it.
Well, the sad thing is that when you're not around anymore, and others who remember it are not around anymore, nobody's going to know about it.
Yeah, the caller makes a really important point here. I'm not familiar with the building, but it sounds as though it helped to give this community its character and its identity.
You see, now the Hall of Fame of Agriculture has been moved to Louisville at Freedom Hall, and the state of Kentucky, the governor, built many, many hallways specially to put the famous pictures, 200 and some of them, that were all the Hall of Fame of Agriculture. It's still going on today. And if you go to the fair down there anytime, go through the Hall of Fame to see all these famous, famous people's pictures. The Hall of Fame paid for the artist, but the family had to furnish the big frame for the portrait. So there's fabulous frames.
Yeah, and there's an instance where you could argue that not only did we lose an historic building, but we lost something that would draw people to Chicago. So perhaps there was being a resource, there's a double loss.
Yeah, increasingly, older structures, older communities are a real catalyst and magnet for what we call heritage tourism. And this can be a real economic force for any community that really appreciates its past and preserves it.
Yeah. I want to thank the last caller, and we have a number of callers. I want to get on to somebody who's here on a car phone. Let's do them on line number four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, thank you.
Uh-huh.
I'm a contractor, and I live in an old, somewhat historic building, an old city firehouse in Chicago, and we have a historic farm down in southern Illinois with log cabins over 150 years old. So I'm in complete concurrence with your sentiments. However, I kind of have to differ on the whole economics of this. It is not just a little bit more expensive to save historic buildings and restore them to modern use. It's a lot more expensive. And while I would agree with you, America is the land of bad taste, and many developers have no taste and don't care about it, it is a lot more expensive to do it. And I think the real issue here is, are Americans willing to pay to save their history? And a lot of Americans aren't. But when somebody comes to you and says, I want an office building and I want to pay $75 a square foot for it, well, you know, architecture is, modern architecture is fundamentally driven by cost. People use vinyl siding not because they necessarily think it looks better, but because it's a lot cheaper than using wood siding. And I think you kind of really got to address this a little more than saying it's just a moderately more expensive. It's a lot more expensive to save old stuff. I've been through it.
Well, we lost the caller, but I think he made his point pretty clear.
Yeah, well, and he makes a valid point. But this varies a lot from community to community and project to project. But he's right that often it is more expensive to restore than to build anew. But this is one of the reasons why we have federal historic tax credits, and increasingly in different states, state historic tax credits, because there's a recognition that there's a public benefit to preserving older structures, and there's a recognition that sometimes you need a financial incentive to do that. Now, on the federal level, there's a 20% federal tax credit for restoring buildings that are on the National Register or eligible for the National Register. That's a very significant help. And it's increasingly used by developers who are savvy and who know how to access it. And, David, you'll have to speak as to whether or not there's a Illinois tax credit, but if there isn't, I know
yeah,
we both want to see one.
Not as yet, Dick. It's something that we've long wanted to have in place. What we do have here in Illinois, however, is a property tax freeze situation, whereby if you spend a certain proportion, a certain percentage of the structure's value on rehabilitating it, you can get a 8 or a 10 year, I can't remember if it's 8 or 10 year, property tax freeze at pre-rehabilitation figures. So that's a huge incentive. We have a Cook County property tax freeze program, which has been very, very successful. And a great incentive to people. There's also the possibility of a preservation easement donation, which can garner for the owner of a property a one-time charitable tax deduction for the value of the easement. But the owner must, the owner must want to perpetually preserve the structure that he owns. Or he wouldn't want to consider an easement because it's a permanent encumbrance on the deed and passes from owner to owner. But that is another incentive that's in place that contractors and individual owners of residential structures can take advantage of.
Hmm. We're just a little bit past the midpoint here, and we'll continue our conversation about historic preservation in just a moment. However, before we do that, there's something else that we need to do because it's the first Tuesday of the month. This is a test of the emergency alert system.
This is a required monthly test of the emergency alert system. This is only a test.
And you're listening to WILL Urbana. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're talking this morning about historic preservation, and let me introduce again our two guests, both of them joining us by telephone. Richard Moe, he is president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and David Ballman, executive director of the Landmarks Preservation Council of Illinois. I want to take at least a couple of minutes here to talk about the Farnsworth House, since I said that we would, and I know that for both of your organizations, keep lists of particular structures that you think are endangered and that are important, and I'm pretty sure that the Farnsworth House is on, I know it's on the Illinois list, I'm pretty sure that it's on both of your lists. This is a house that was designed by a very, very famous architect, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, and it's near Aurora. And the current owner of the house, who everyone says has been a good owner, taking fine care of the house. He just says he wants to sell it. And apparently there's at least one person who's interested in buying the house, but what he wants to do is to move it so that there the house would be preserved, presumably, but it would be a loss to Illinois. Why is it that, maybe I'll go first to David Ballman, why is it that you and the other folks here involved in preservation in Illinois want to maintain the Farnsworth House and keep it here in the state?
The Farnsworth House, David, is an architectural icon, and we don't give that moniker to too many buildings. It's an architectural icon of international importance. Every architect, every architectural student, every aficionado of architecture reveres this work of art as probably one of the most sublime works of architecture of the 20th century. Certainly, when you're talking about the modernist movement, it's one of the 10 structures in the world that has the kind of reverence attached to it. It is without a doubt an architectural treasure of international importance, and we're very lucky to have it here in Illinois. Mies is associated very strongly with Chicago because of his creation of the Illinois Institute of Technology as the premier architecture school for Miesian theory. This was done in the late 40s and the early 50s. It's very important that Chicago and Illinois maintain its hold on this building as a symbol of a very, very important architectural movement that really developed greatly here in Chicago. There are other works by Mies that predate this, the Barcelona Pavilion and the Tugendhat House in Brno in the Czech Republic, that are equally famous as international pieces of architecture. We've got one here in the United States, a residence by Mies. He did mostly commercial buildings, very few residential buildings. We want to keep it here.
I would just add, and certainly second everything David says about the significance of the house, it is arguably the most significant house built in America in the 20th century. And from our point of view, it is unique at this time because it is also at risk. Lord Farnsworth, as you say, has been a good steward, but it is now up for sale at Sotheby's on December 12th, up for auction. And there are no legal protections on it. There is at least one individual that is interested in buying it and moving it, which would be an architectural disaster of the first order, in our view, because Mies designed this very special house in a very special place, and that's on the banks of the Fox River in Plano. And to take it out of its original context would be to do great damage to its significance. So this building deserves to be a museum, we think. It deserves to be open to the public in addition to being preserved. And we have come together, our two organizations, in a partnership, and it's really a wonderful partnership, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate the leadership that David Ballman and LPCI are bringing to this, so that we can hopefully purchase this building at auction on December 12th, and it would become a National Trust historic site, but it would be operated by the Landmarks Preservation Council of Illinois. This is a perfect arrangement from our point of view, and the kind of partnership that that we think will bring the greatest value to this very significant structure.
Well, let me ask you yet another very important question, because it deals with the issue of rights of ownership. There would have been a time when it would have been possible for this building to be placed on the Illinois Register of Historic Places, and that would mean that it would be protected from being torn down or any major alterations, any changes that the person wanting to make. Essentially, they could not do that. Then, in 1989, the General Assembly passed an amendment prohibiting the state from adding property to the register if the owner doesn't consent to the designation. So here now we come down to what is a very difficult issue in all sorts of ways, and that is balancing the individual property rights of an owner of a house like this against what we think are some sort of common interest in preserving part of our cultural heritage like this building. I mean, how do you resolve that conflict between some kind of idea of a common interest and the rights of individual property owners?
Well, clearly there has to be a balance here. Property rights under our system deserve great respect, and we give them great respect. But so do community rights and the preservation of historic structures of great significance. That's why David made reference to earlier to preservation ordinances in different communities in Illinois. There is no such ordinance in Plano or in that county protecting this structure. I wish there were. When it comes to protecting individual sites, it does take owner consent, whether either through the kind of placement on the national or state register that you mentioned, or through the imposition of an easement, which is a device that we increasingly use to protect historic structures like this. And David Baumann and I have agreed that one of the first things we will do if we acquire this property is to put a protective easement on it so that it cannot be moved or altered at any time in the future.
One of the things that we do, David, when communities come to us and say, you know, we are very upset because 25% of our historic building stock of our town has disappeared in the last 10 years, and we want to protect it. So we want to enact a preservation ordinance. And the advice that we always give them is that if you're going to go to the trouble to create an ordinance, it has to be an ordinance that carries with it no owner consent provision. But it also carries the responsibility for the community to do a very good, solid survey of what their historic resources are. Some preservationists are not well educated in terms of architectural history, and it may be difficult for them to distinguish between what's truly a wonderful building and what truly is not a wonderful building. And therefore, it takes some professional expertise on the part of a community to objectively look at their historic resources and rank them in a very, very well-done survey. Then the community can say, okay, here are the 150 or 250 structures in our town which we know objectively have great historic or architectural importance, and we will enhance the public benefit concept in our community by enacting a landmark ordinance which protects these 150 buildings without any owner consent provision.
Well, we have a number of other callers, and I want to try to at least to get two, three, as many as we can in the time that remains. Let's go next to Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Your guests have been discussing the importance of saving the best of our built environment. I was hoping for comments on the environment that we're building today. I think about traditional department stores, and they tended to be, at least the ones that are still around, beautifully built, and they tended to be in downtown. And I know that not everything that was built 50 years ago or more was of great quality and worth saving, but it's kind of hard to see anybody fighting in another 50 or 75 years to save a big box store or a strip mall that's been built recently. What are we building now that will be worth saving in 50 or 75 years?
Well, that's a very good question. And in my view, it's a troubling question because we're not building enough that I think is going to be worth preserving in 40 or 50 years. You know, we used to put a lot of time and effort and money into building great public structures, whether they're courthouses or schools or colleges and universities. And that's because we honored the function that took place in those buildings, whether it was justice or education or whatever. That's not happening anymore, or at least not enough. Today's schools are largely big boxes, characterless, windowless. It's questionable even how well they're serving their educational functions. That's one of the reasons we're trying to preserve older neighborhood schools for a whole range of reasons. There is some good architecture being done and some very creative and innovative architecture being done by contemporary architects. But it's not finding its way often enough, in my view, into the public realm. And that's disturbing, particularly where public buildings are concerned. And it's certainly true where new retail concerns are. You know, we have become a nation of strip malls. And as we all know, it's awfully hard to find character in a strip mall.
I think Dick is absolutely right, and we don't want to say categorically that there aren't good architects using good materials and building very good buildings, but the percentage is very, very small compared to what it was say, before the Second World War. Planned obsolescence is certainly a concept that we've all not only grown to live with, but in general, it's accepted by the building community. It's a very, very difficult situation. We have grown used, we have been accustomed to mediocrity architecturally, and we don't mind it a bit anymore is the problem.
Do you have any suggestions for how communities can try to encourage higher quality development in their areas?
I think professionals on planning commissions and building committees, people who are educated and conversant in design, architecture, construction techniques, it's a level of education and a level of professionalism that many communities have trouble finding.
As David says, too often people and communities are too willing to accept what's presented to them. But they don't have to. Communities can determine what they want their character to be, what they want the community character to be, and that includes design and architecture. And if a big box retailer comes to town, the community has every right to say, we don't like that design, we think you should improve that design or that location, and make it fit into our community.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to Chicago, line number 3. Hello.
Hi, my question is a general one that comes out of a specific point and kind of ties into the last caller's question. The specific situation that I'm thinking of is the effort to save the rock seawall at Promontory Point on the south side of Chicago. This is a community that has done what your guests have suggested, which is they have worked together and have decided together in an extraordinarily unified way to try to save this historic park structure, and are battling against a government, the city government, which is at times reluctant and at times hostile to that idea. And so my question is, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about strategies within that dynamic. One would think the government represents the public, but often, rather than being at battle with a private developer, a community that recognizes an historic resource and wants to save it is actually working against the government. What are some ideas or strategies working within that dynamic?
Well, I should remind the caller that the Park District here in Chicago, as wonderful as they have been on the rehabilitation and restoration of park buildings throughout the city, as well as parks, boathouses, beach houses, they've done a phenomenal job. But it is the same said agency that's responsible for Soldier Field. There are times, I'm afraid there are times when deals are cut and put in place, oftentimes not in with public transparency. And, you know, you can go all the way to the Supreme Court of the state of Illinois, and it's not going to make a difference. Politics is a very, very important part of preservation. And I think the preservation movement, if it can integrate itself with the political process as deeply and as early as possible, you can avoid situations like this. But sometimes the politics are just so strong that there's nothing you can do about it.
It's interesting. In this case, the private property owner right, that is the consent of the owner being required for historic preservation, works against the public because the owner is the government, that is the park district, and they are refusing to give their consent for preservation. It's ironic that a public body is the roadblock rather than a private owner using that particular provision of the law.
Well, it really is ironic. No question about it, and would that it weren't so. I hope you take some comfort from the fact that we at the National Trust are very much on your side on this issue. I just recently sent a letter to the authorities urging them to reconsider their position.
Thanks to both of you, and thanks for answering the question.
All right, thank you for the call. We got a couple of other callers here. We'll try to get at least one. We've got someone on a cell phone here, line 4. Hello? The caller there on line 4? Let's go to line 1 then in Champaign County. Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
Saved by the cell phone. Speaking of public agencies that have been a bad actor, I think that we can point at the Maxwell Street facade, and also I think they turned it into a strip mall. I'm not sure on that, but that's the University of Illinois, a land-grant university, which ought to have as a cultural cultural value as some value, but I guess the corporatization of the university is, that's another discussion, though.
That's a good discussion, though. We could speak for hours about it.
Okay, we don't have a moment. I wanted actually that if you want to say something about that, but also the point about the economics. Hasn't preservation overtaken new building, as the biggest economic phenomena? There's something to be said for that, as far as we don't have this edifice complex anymore. We don't have to build the bigger building and all that sort of thing. We actually ought to be working where people live as opposed to creating another monument.
Well, exactly. There are many arguments supporting that kind of work, and one of them increasingly is economics. I mean, there's great economic value to redoing these older buildings and neighborhoods in terms of the employment it offers, in terms of the rising property values, and so forth. And that should not be ignored.
There are many developers in town that I've spoken to here in Chicago who have not one preservation bone in their body, yet they have to admit to me that a beautifully rehabilitated older building will sell much better, and people will be much more much happier with it in the end than anything, any at least mediocre condominium or apartment building that one can build for $75 a square foot. There is, I think, even if you're not oriented historically toward anything, there is greater pleasure in living with a beautiful old building than a new one, provided that the new construction is not of anything more than mediocre value. We battle agencies. The University of Illinois, I was in Champaign yesterday talking with the university, talking with the head of facilities and planning to make sure that they understand the importance of not only the buildings on the Champaign-Urbana campus, but also all of the important historic resources in the whole university system. Maxwell Street was an atrocious and an egregious ignoring of what was there. The state of Illinois also agreed. The advisory council of the Historic Preservation Agency here in Illinois wanted to push that as an historic district. But again, the politics got in the way.
I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop just because we've used our time. I have to jump in there. And I just have enough time to thank the guest, Mr. Ballman. I appreciate you giving us your time.
Thank you.
Our guest, David Ballman, he's Executive Director of the Landmarks Preservation Council of Illinois, and also Richard Moe, President of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Mr. Moe, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been nice. It's nice being with you.